all. It's Daisy. Today, we have an interview with the one and only surprised eel historian, and I am as excited as you are to dive in, so I'll keep this brief. One, we had some audio issues and I ended up needing to redo a lot of my audio, so I apologize for any weirdness that results. Two, we've hit 10,000 downloads! Thank you all so much for your love of our Silly Little Eel Show. Three, I'm afraid this will be the last bonus content for a while. Lou and I are very busy, and we'll be focusing on our work and on season two, so we won't have time to make monthly content. If you miss us, keep an eye on our socials. Okay, that's all for now. Let's get into it. Okay, dear listeners, this is your notably esteemed eel enthusiast, Daisy McNamara, and today we have a very special guest with us. Do we want to do names and pronouns at the start for everybody?
Sure.
All right, so you know me, Daisy, she and he pronouns.
I'm Lou, they, them pronouns.
And I am John Wyatt Greenlee, he, him. I am an eel historian, maybe one of the only eel historians in the world.
Which is the coolest job that anyone can have.
It's not so much a job at this point because it doesn't actually pay me anything, but it's still kind of fun.
Just the passion. Yeah. You love eels that much. I respect it, honestly.
I do.
Yes, I have no eel-related income at the moment. This is just all the eels are for fun.
All the eels are for fun. Well, it leads to income in other ways, and we can talk about that later on. But, like, it's, yeah.
Awesome. So, you have introduced yourself as the eel historian. So, will you just tell us a little bit about yourself? What else do you do besides eel history?
Right, yeah. So, I have a PhD in medieval studies. I'm a medieval historian and a historian of maps and cartographic history. And that led me to eels in ways that I think we'll probably talk about later on. So as far as eels go, I am primarily interested in the ways that eels sort of are reflected in the role they play in cultural production and the ways that people think about eels and use them as part of culture. So I'm less interested in like the sort of natural history of the animal and more in the sort of human cultural history with eels. So academia being what it is right now, I don't actually have a job teaching or anything else like that, or researching. So this is what I wrote my doctoral dissertation on, was eel history in England from about 500 to about 1500 or so. But at this point, what I do for work is I draw maps. I draw sort of custom maps on commission, mostly for academic history books and things like that.
That is very cool. We will get into maps later. And I feel it with the academia. I'm also on the job hunt.
I gave up on that.
Yeah, fair enough, honestly. It is so hard right now.
I am still in academia. I'm a data manager for clinical trials. So
for the birds.
Possibly avoid ever leaving academia, I will do so.
It's hard lines. Okay, so you mentioned this a little bit. If you want to go into detail, why eels? What got you interested in them? Besides them being the most perfect creatures, as we all know.
Right. Well, I didn't know anything about eels until partway through my doctoral work. I thought I was going to write my dissertation about sort of maps and spatial production and the way that people think about and reproduce space and what that means. And for a non-eel-related paper, I was doing some research looking at maps of London from the 17th century. I was interested in, like, thinking about spatial production in London around the time of the Great Fire. And what I noticed on a number of these maps of London, these sort of big, pretty city view maps, is a lot of them had these two ships on the Thames labeled eel ships. And that stood out to me for a couple of reasons. One, because eels, I didn't know anything at all about eels, so that just seemed kind of weird. I think if they'd been like herring or something like that, maybe I wouldn't have noticed quite so much. But the other thing that really stood out to me about that is that they had a label. So the only other things on these maps, there are lots of other ships on these maps. The whole Thames is like littered with them, with ships. But none of them have labels. The only other things on the map that have labels are big civic monuments like the Tower of London or the Globe Theatre or neighborhoods. So big physical parts of the city that can't like up anchor and sail away. And then you have these two ships with a label. And I wondered why on Earth they had, like, well, how it had come to be that they were so important, that they were like enough of a landmark that they showed up on these maps. And that sort of seemed like, I was trying to find a topic for a seminar paper that seemed like a decent place to start, although when I went and talked to the professor of the class, I was like, I don't know that I'm actually going to be able to find enough material here. I have no idea what I'm like, what I'm doing with it. I don't know what there is. Like, maybe it's a really easy answer. I don't know. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get 30 pages out of this. And he said, go ahead, just see what you can do. If it's like 20 pages, it's 20 pages, and that's fine. Like, that's how historical research goes sometimes, right? Like, you pull on threads, and sometimes there's something really interesting there, and sometimes there's nothing there. And so I wrote the paper trying to get a sense of like what these ships were doing there and why. And it was a really interesting topic. But by the time I got done, and I got to 30 pages pretty easily, by the time I got done, I had a lot more questions than I had answers. And it was, they were really interesting questions. And so I wanted to kind of keep pulling on that thread. And so I thought, I still wasn't thinking of like that as like the primary focus of my research, though, until I started actually writing the dissertation. My initial thought was that I was still going to write about like sort of spatial production in London in like the early modern period, and that I could use these ships as an entry point, right? As sort of a first chapter to get to thinking about sort of unusual versions of space and contestation and nationalism, because they're Dutch eel ships. They're not English, as it turns out. So I was thinking about like all sorts of fancy academic ways of sort of unpacking what's going on these maps as a way to get into a broader topic about spatial production. And then I started writing and writing and writing and writing and writing. And like at some point I looked up and I realized it was like 130, 140 pages into this thing. And I was still writing just about eels. And I hadn't gotten very far. Like I hadn't gotten up to the ships yet. I was still just writing about like, because what I wound up doing was like trying to figure out like, okay, so these ships are important enough to be landmarks. Why are they important enough to be landmarks? And you start sort of pulling on that thread, and it turns out that eels are super important in English cultural history over the previous like 1,000+ years. So I was trying to like cram all of that into one chapter, and it just didn't work. It was like, this is like a 140-page chapter. And so I went to my...
There's just so much to say about eels.
There was. And
this
so
was
I went
just
to my
your introduction that had then expanded to an entire thesis.
Yes. And so I went to my I went to my dissertation committee, and I was like, hey, guys.
I've written the thesis.
So it's we're just doing eels is the thing. It's just going to be about eels because I'm like halfway through the length, what I anticipate to be the length of this, and I haven't gotten even up to where I wanted to start. So, and they were...
Oh, so that's why you're the surprised eel historian. It was a surprise.
Yes,
even
no,
you.
And that's the surprise in the Twitter handle there is like, I did not anticipate this at all, but it wound up being a really fascinating topic. And one of the things that like, one of the reasons that I sort of followed it up was, you know, it's a PhD dissertation is 4 or 5 years worth of work. You have to be able to get up every morning and be really interested in the thing, or most mornings at least, and sort of be willing
at
to
at least
sit
not
down.
Go insane. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Or, you know, and a lot of people get to the end of their doctoral program and they're like sick and tired of their topic. They're like, oh my God, I never want to think about this thing ever again. I really loved my topic. Like, it was really fascinating. I kept learning things. And the reason that you know me at this point is because like while I was doing that over the course of sort of writing the dissertation and doing research, I would tweet like random weird eel facts that I found in archival records. And part of that, like eels are kind of intrinsically funny. A lot of eel history is just sort of like, and because culturally we've really moved away from eels as a part of our diet, especially in the US, but even in England too, they feel distant and distinct and kind of othered. And so sort of pointing out to people that like, hey, like the King of England used to order 40,000 of these for a feast, people are like, that's crazy. And so I sort of started tweeting things out as I found them in the archives, and that developed into its own thing. And then at some point I looked up and realized I was like doing one eel history tweet a day with like memes and things, and it developed a life of its own. And so that's been really fun, like being able to take the work I do as a medievalist and make it matter in a sort of modern public context. It's not always something medievalists get to do. So that's been fun to be able to take my work and make it matter to people. And we'll probably get to this later, but that you know, eels, as I'm sure everybody listening here knows, are critically endangered fish, and it's hard to get people interested in saving them because they're not this sort of charismatic megafauna,
they're not
right?
Pandas.
Yeah,
or,
they're not particularly charismatic or a particularly well-liked creature. People think they're weird. People think they're gross. Anytime I tell someone that like eels are one of my favorite animals, they just go, "Why?"
Yeah, no, they're slimy and they're weird and they're gross. We don't really have anything to do with them anymore. They remind people of snakes often. And like my most common reaction when I tell people that I study eels is like, "Oh, I hate eels because I watched The Tin Drum when I was a kid and it freaked me out." And so it's really hard to get people on board with the idea of saving them, but you know, it's terribly important.
There is an issue, especially in parts of the U.S. Solomon David talks about this, who is a well-known gar scientist, about the issues of getting people interested in saving these very cool, very important fish that are not as charismatic and that we don't have a value for, that we don't fish for. I think he was talking about, I don't know if you're familiar with the relationship between red knots and horseshoe crabs, but red knots are a migratory bird that survives off horseshoe crab eggs, and horseshoe crabs are a very, very valuable species, both commercially and making vaccines and just generally. But it's almost impossible to get anyone to legislate protection of them because they are creepy looking and they're weird. So I believe it was red knot protection. Birders got involved in protecting horseshoe crabs in the interest of the knots. You have to sort of make it. It's a way of marketing, like this charismatic animal will survive and then you'll be able to save X amount of less charismatic creatures.
I've seen this from zoologists as well, like talking about charismatic megafauna and how that the charismatic megafauna protecting its environment has a knock-on effect on all the other biodiversity within that environment. So yeah, maybe everybody's like, "Ugh, the pandas again." But actually, when a lot of the conservation work that's done to preserve the pandas also preserves the ecosystem around the pandas too. So I feel like eels are kind of like deliberately uncharismatic megafauna. Like you can use the uncharismaticness of the eels to be like, "Oh, look at these weird things. Aren't they cool?"
And,
you know,
I've done a lot of that, of being, yeah, this sort of like, "Oh my God, look how crazy this is. Isn't this fun?" But it's generally, it didn't start out this way. It started out just being like, "Here's a random crazy weird thing I found in the archive." But for the last several years, a lot of the focus of the work I do, and I still do eel tweets every day, has really been, and I bring people back to this every once in a while, really been like with the goal of getting people interested in eels sort of and thinking about them as something that's worth thinking about, worth saving, right? It's like, okay, we have this really long and complicated and interesting past with this animal. It's a really fascinating animal with this crazy and amazing life cycle, and you should know about it. And so, you know, like, that is where I try to aim a lot of the work that I do, even if it doesn't sort of look like that on the surface most days, is sort of trying to get people interested in eels.
Okay. All for it. That is
yep.
God's work, as I'm sure we all agree.
Whatever you can do to raise awareness, even if you're sneaking it in by means of memes.
And then every once in a while, I'll do a more serious thread to be like, "Hey, do you know that eels are critically endangered? And hey, do you know they're the most smuggled animal on Earth? And like, they need our help, man."
They do. So if we've gotten into this a little, but our next question is, can you tell us a little bit about the relationship between eels and people as relates to your research? We've done that a little.
Yeah. So like I said, that's sort of the focus of a lot of the academic work that I wound up doing, was sort of thinking about the roles that eels played in my focus ended up being on medieval and early modern England. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One, like you have to sort of pick an area, but also, as it turns out, the English history with eels is sort of more rich and complicated than most other countries. Not all. The Netherlands has a really interesting history as well. And eels are eaten broadly across the world and in Europe, but England has a particular long cultural history with eels that's unique. And part of it comes from the fact that they just eat a ton of them, way more. There are eels in archaeological, like eel remains in archaeological sites all over the place in England in a way that there are not on the continent. They're just sort of ubiquitous. And this goes back at least to the Romans. There's some evidence the Romans brought eel eating to England. That's a little uncertain.
They brought rabbits, so I wouldn't be surprised if they brought eels too.
That's interesting. Well, not that they brought the eels with them. There were eels here, but the custom? Yeah, the archaeological
eating
evidence.
Eating weird food was definitely a Roman thing.
Yeah. There's evidence of eel eating from archaeological remains and on the continent where there isn't in England, sort of early Iron Age. And so it's possible that the Romans did love their eels, and it's quite possible that they brought the idea of eating eels with them. The English before that seemed to have eaten a lot of amphibians and frogs and fish, but not a lot of eels. But by the time you get to, like, you know, the 6th, 7th century, they're eating a ton of eels. The isotope analysis from dental remains from the South Saxons in, like, the 7th century or so shows that they were eating more eels than they were eating all of their freshwater fish combined and all of their marine fish combined. So, like, eating a huge number of eels. And so they're an enormous part of the diet, and they will talk about eel rents in a little bit. They wind up being a part of the economy in a lot of different ways, both in terms of, like, people paying for rent in eels, but also they're renting eels, but also sort of buying and selling eels. And partly because of this, they wind up, their sort of general cultural ubiquity means that they show up in a lot of other ways. They show up in art and literature and language. There's eels on the Bayeux Tapestry. Shakespeare mentions eels in his writing more than any other fish. And you know, they're just sort of everywhere. The more you look, the more eels you find. And what I said, that England has a sort of unique cultural history with eels. And one of the places you can see this is in art. So a lot of, there's English reproductions of continental art styles in the medieval period will often, like, add an eel to them, which is interesting. And like English portrayals of St. Christopher, and St. Christopher winds up on, as a really important figure on the, like, parish church wall frescoes in the 12th century. There's a ton of them all over England, and a huge number of them in England have eels in the water. Some of them actually show St. Christopher as an eel fisherman. So, like, instead of leaning on a staff, he's leaning on an eel spear. And this is unique to England. You see them sometimes in the water in Christopher images from the continent, but much less often. In England, it's fairly ubiquitous. So, like, the eels sort of show up in all of these places that tell us, among other things, just sort of point to their general importance. There are a ton of eel metaphors. You know, at this point in English, we have, like, one eel metaphor, the sort of slippery as an eel, right, which is negative. And pre-modern England has a lot of eel metaphors. They use eels as metaphors for bad things, as we do. Slippery as an eel is not usually, it's sort of pejorative, right? But eel metaphors can also be good or bad. And this is one of the things that's been really interesting to me, actually. Sorry, this is a bit of a tangent. But is that I have found that so most modern historians don't think about eels much at all because they're not a part of our world so much. And so most readings of eels in historical archives by modern historians have tended to be negative. They see, like, when they see an eel metaphor, they assume it is a negative one, rather than, like, thinking that it might in fact be more nuanced, that you're talking about a society where that values eels and so is using them sometimes metaphorically as bad, as, like, slippery as an eel is, I mean, that's a really old one that goes back to the ancient Greeks and is usually bad, but also can be, there are instances of, like, they're using eels for the sort of a good metaphor to mean something good. And that has often been misread by historians who just look at it through a modern lens. And so they're only thinking about eels in negative contexts. So that's been really interesting to me.
That is really interesting.
I'm fascinated by the idea of St. Christopher with the eel trident, the ones they use for I saw one of those recently in Ely. They have, like, one as a
Land.
The Promised Land of Ely. They have, like, a decorative one in one of their on their eel trail with just, like, a sort of sculpture made out of sort of three eel tridents all held together. And I'd never seen, like, an eel trident before. I had no idea how they were caught. So the idea of having St. Christopher as, Jesus slung on his back and a big eel trident in one hand to find his way across the ford is very interesting.
Yeah, there are four or five extant wall paintings of Christopher, like, as an eel fisherman. And they're all in the Fens, which you would sort of expect. But like, that's a... You know, that's an instance of the artist sort of trying to make the saint sort of...
Localize
and make, like, let people who come into that church be able to sort of identify with them.
It's really interesting. I'm wondering, and this is slightly off topic, I'm wondering what changed with the attitude towards eels, or maybe just with their ubiquity dwindling, overfishing and such like. Maybe different environmental stuff as we see less eels. I'm wondering if they started to be creepier.
Was it over the course of the sort of 20th century as the population started to crash that so, the view changed? Or
broadly, yes. I think actually I would point to a little bit earlier than that.
Okay.
So one of the, we'll maybe get back to talking about the eel ships, but these eel ships that initially caught my interest, they're Dutch eel ships, and they are basically big floating aquariums, essentially. Like they're well ships, so the holds are full of water and they're full of live eels. And so they're catching live eels in Holland and then later in Denmark, and they're bringing them over to London and sort of parking these ships on the Thames. And then you take a small boat out to the ship, and they sort of scoop out your eels for you and give them to you, and off you go. So they start doing this trade in like the 1450s or so, something like that, mid 15th century. And these ships stay on the Thames until 1938. That's when the last of them leaves. Although by the time you get into the 1930s, like they're really not doing a lot of business. By then you're sort of, as you said, the 20th century is when you see a real sort of total drop off in eel, sort of eel popularity. But there's a moment, there's like a sort of 20 year gap in the mid 17th century. 15 years really, so like between 1666 and 1681, where their ships aren't on the Thames. It's the middle of the Anglo-Dutch Wars.
So Elizabeth the First is to blame for the for the lack of popularity of eels. Then no.
Yet another thing I can blame on the monarchy.
Yeah. So this is actually more Charles II. So over the course of the 17th century, there's this sort of growing concern in London. You can see it play. You can see it sort of evidenced in a number of plays and the way that eel ships in London are being talked about in London plays. They're becoming more and more concerned about the Dutch sort of control over the eel industry and sort of the Dutch, sort of weird semi-sovereign Dutch space in the Thames, which is one of the things I was initially going to write my dissertation on. Like this, like you have these like Dutch ships that are part of the city, but also aren't. And so you can see a lot of sort of concern playing out here, and the Dutch wind up being at this point the sort of they have sort of a de facto monopoly on eel sales in the city, because they're the only people that know how to make these ships, so the only people who know how to transport live eels in bulk. And London is more or less sort of outstripped its capacity, its local carrying capacity of its streams and things to get its own eels. So if you want live eels, probably you're getting them from the Dutch, from these ships. And there's sort of a growing concern about this, sort of early nationalist ideas, and eel eating is a bit tied to English, early English senses of nationalism in some interesting ways. And so, like, there's a lot of tension here. And in 1666, these Dutch ships get kicked off the Thames with a law sort of aimed at encouraging English eel fishing. They get invited back essentially in 1681 because it turns out the English can't supply London with enough eels.
Eels.
Yeah, pretty much. There are a couple of anonymous petitions to Parliament being like, hey, look, we're draining the fens, which is our own native eel habitat. We don't know how to carry these things in bulk anyway. Like, we need our eels, and the only people that can get them to us are the Dutch, and we really need to invite these guys back. And so they do. So there's this, but there's this like 15-year gap where there aren't these eel ships on the Thames and where London isn't eating eels, or not nearly as many. And I think I can point to that as a real moment of shift. Before that, you've still got a really active sort of English eel culture that is a little bit like, the best way I found to describe it is to think about it as sort of like the way we would now think about England as having a tea culture. Like, it's important. It's like a really, it shows up in the culture in tons of different ways. It's not necessarily always like surface level, but it's always kind of there. And the eels are sort of that. So prior to 1666, you still see this. The eels show up in plays and in metaphors and in family crests and art and all kinds of things. And that goes away after the ships leave. So they come back in 1681, but there's a real noticeable drop off in sort of other instances of eels in culture production, right? And it's always hard to you always have to take cultural production in early modern England with a bit of a grain of salt, because so much of it comes out of London that it's easy to think about London as meaning England, and it doesn't. London is London. So
that is still the case.
Yeah. So, but it's tricky, because that's where we have like so much information. But it is problematic to read London as being a stand-in for all of England. That said,
yes. As a Mancunian, I entirely agree.
That said, there's a real noticeable drop-off after like the mid-17th century, where suddenly you're not seeing eels in metaphor. You're not seeing them in plays. You're not seeing them in art anymore. They're just sort of where you start seeing them showing up in literature is primarily in, like, you get natural histories. And then, like, after a little bit, you get, like, Isaac Walton's History of the Angler. Like, that kind of book starts talking about eels as, like, a fish that we should study rather than, like, something, because like all the eels in Shakespeare are used metaphorically. So there's this real shift where I think what happens is eels stop being a fish that everybody eats. So prior to the ships leaving, like, everybody from the king down to peasants is eating eels, and by and large enjoying one of the little bits of history from here I really enjoy is, like, right after the parliament kicks the eel ships off, the king has his eel procurer go over to Holland and try to buy a couple of these ships because he wants his eels, and there's no other way to get them. So, like, after the ships come back, people go back to eating eels, but it really becomes much more of a poor person's food. It sort of, over the course of that sort of 15 years or so, I think it really picks up a lower class sensibility that it holds on to. So, like,
yeah,
by
that's
the time
definitely a thing in the 19th century, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. By the time you get to the 19th century,
down there.
Right. When Mayhew's writing about, like, the London poor, right, he's writing about eels as an important part of the diet. It's like, you know, the second most commonly purchased street food after dog meat, which is not like dogs that you eat, but like food for your dogs. It's like, so the Dutch come back and they keep selling eels, and they're by far the primary seller of eels in London, but it has become essentially a street food and not much else. And it kind of stays that way. By the time you get into the early 20th century, it's a real, like, East End kind of poor person's food. You get jellied eels.
That's still how we think of it, yeah. Like,
yeah,
as a kind of...
It's possible that there were medieval jellied eels, but as because medieval people knew how to jelly things, but all the evidence we have for jellied eels, like, kind of starts in England, starts in the 19th century. So it picks up this real lower class sensibility, and a colleague mentioned to me that it has sort of a reverse trajectory to a lobster, right? And it maintains that through the 20th century. And then in the early 20th century, you get sort of increased access to a lot of different varieties of food and better refrigeration and trucking, the capacity to you know, to bring food from further away. And that broadens the diet for a lot of people. And as generally happens, when poor people can eat like the people they see as being above their station, they will do it. You know, we always want to...
Conspicuous consumption.
Yeah, we always want to mimic the people that are sort of higher up the social ladder than we are, because we want to feel better about ourselves. And so I think that sort of shift in the early 20th century broadens out the spectrum of the foods that people can eat. It's a bit of a death knell for eel consumption in England. And in the US, they ate eels in the colonial period and a little bit after, but like it was never a significant part of the culture so much. But in England, I think that's kind of where I would point to, that like there's a shift in the late 17th century, and then you get into the 19th and 20th centuries. And once sort of poor people can eat like richer people, they do, and that's sort of the end of the eel. So like those eel ships stay on the Thames to 1938, but by the end they're not really selling many eels, and they leave on the eve of the Second World War, and they don't come back. After the Second World War, the Dutch start shipping eels into Yarmouth and carting them into London by truck, but in much smaller numbers. So it's just not really kind of the same thing. So I know that's a really long answer to your question, but I think that's kind of the trajectory that I would point to.
Does a similar thing happen on the continent as well? Like, do the Dutch continue? Does it fall out of fashion for the Dutch as well? Or
yeah, so the continental history with eels in the 20th century is a little bit different. So one of the things that happens in the late 19th century is that they develop essentially a hot smoking process. So like if you buy a smoked eel now, it's like this sort of savory, tasty fish, right? It's rich and fishy tasting, kind of oily, but really like smoky and good. Medieval in early modern smoking was a cold smoking process that is much more like drying, essentially. It took a lot longer, and you wind up with a fish that doesn't really taste very good at the end of it. So in the like mid to late 19th century, on the continent, they developed this hot smoking process for eels. And so eels actually, there's a moment of like 50 years or so between like 1880 and 1930 or so, when eels on the continent are what's the word I want? They're sort of fancy.
They're kind of in fashion.
The sort of hot smoking process makes them a fish that is fashionable to eat and people really enjoy. And like, you know, if you go to the North Sea now and like walk up the beach, like there'll be people selling eels from carts, and they're like, there'll be these kind of smoked eels. So it's still fairly popular in like northern Germany and in the Netherlands. But that, for some reason, and I don't know why, but for some reason that sort of never catches on in England. And maybe because eels have this sort of deeply ingrained sense of being a lower class food in a way that they don't quite so much on the continent. They're sort of less a part of the cultural history in general. So on the continent, you get this sort of moment of like 50 years or so where eels are fancy again, and that never happens in England.
Interesting. Hmm. All right.
Yeah, thank you.
What's next on our list? We mentioned eel rent before. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, well, it's obviously it's where you pay your rent in eels. Doesn't everybody do that?
I will ask my landlady, but I don't think she'll be happy about it.
Again, I have never lived in the Fens or anywhere that would require it. So,
right. So, it is what it's kind of what it sounds like. It is paying rent in eels. So, I'm gonna back up a little bit time wise. So, in pre-Norman England, there's not a whole lot of currency floating around. They haven't minted a whole lot of coins, and the coins that they have minted, that the monarchy has minted, they tend to stay among the upper class. They don't really use them to buy things. They kind of trade them back and forth as status symbols, essentially.
Too many different kings, I imagine, running around at the time.
Yeah, and so if you're a landlord and you want to collect rent from your tenants, which is the point of being a landlord, right? They don't have money to pay you, and so instead you collect your rent in in-kind things. So in eggs or grain or honey or ale or eels. And it turns out that eels are one of the most sort of numerous and common of these in-kind rents. There are more eels being paid in rent in the Doomsday Book than there's like grain being paid in rent. So part of my dissertation work was sort of like trying to count up all of the eel rents and see like how many people were paying. And I can point to, like, by the end of the beginning of the 12th century, so like 1100 or so, I can point to a little more than 540,000 eels being paid in rent in England every year. And some of these are really small rents, like 50 rents, 75, like 50 eels, 75 eels. And some of them are really big. The Earl of Chester gets a rent of 75,000 eels every year from, I can never remember the name of the little town. It's just a little town. It's a little south of Lincoln. But I don't know what he did with them, frankly.
It's a lot of eels for one man.
It's a lot of eels for one man. And it
was fairly far across the country as well. Like Lincoln is a reasonable distance from Chester as well.
Yes. And so these are being, and I don't know the payment mechanism there either. Like if he's being paid, like if they're going to like local people that I have no idea.
Shipped all these eels across Nottinghamshire to get to Chester, right? And
so
over.
these are all eels that are being paid as, these are not live eels, almost all of them. They are salted and then smoked. So they're generally caught in the fall during their downstream migration. So they're silver eels mostly. Then they are salted and then smoked. It's this cold smoking process over a period of like 2 to 3 months. So it takes a long time. And then they're generally paid in the spring, like right about now, very often right before Lent.
You put them in barrels?
You can put them, like lie them, stack them on your wagon, and then you sort of cart them off to your landlord. And what he does with them, this is a question I get sometimes, like, well, like, yeah, where did the Earl of Chester like put all of these eels? Like, I don't actually know.
We just really liked eels.
Presumably they ate them, because they would have had to host a lot of people. Anybody who was an eel of anywhere would have had to host a lot of people regularly all the time. So.
Right. And that's part of it. Like they do, these are almost all eventually, hopefully, eaten. Right. And when you start breaking down eel rents into like some of the big monastic houses like Ely collect a lot, like several hundred thousand eels a year in rent from like all of their various places. which is a lot. But when you start breaking it down by like, okay, so like 365 days a year, and there's like 60 monks here, and they're eating three times a day, and then they've got these satellite places that they're maybe sending eels to. When you start breaking it down like that, it becomes, I don't want to say reasonable, because that's still like an enormous number of eels, but it becomes more...
They might be running a hospital as well, or...
Yeah, it starts to become more like, okay, like I can see that. It's not just, if you start thinking about it in terms of like number of people and number of days and sort of obligations. And yeah, so like the Earl of Chester is going to have feasts. So, you know, King Henry and King John, Henry III and King John, we have a lot of, they very often ordered eels from Cambridge and other places for the Christmas feasts, and they tended to order 20,000 to 40,000 at a time. Mm-hmm. And so
that's presumably the entire court that's being fed there in eels.
Yeah. So like, you know, big feast. So
lavish feast of eels.
40,000. And like, there's lots of other food too. So it's not just an eel fest, but it's still a lot of eels. So I can point to, at about 1,100, I can point to 540,000, a little more than that, eels being paid in rent. I know that number is low because a lot of that is coming out of the Domesday Book, which doesn't look at London, doesn't look at anything north of the Humber, and misses things. So like, there's
all of that had been burned during the hiring of the North, if memory serves.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So there's it's more than that, and like part of the reason I know it's more than that too is because like sometimes in the historical record, what I'll find, like, I will know there's a rent because I will find a court record saying, like talking about a rent that I didn't know existed otherwise. So, like, in the 13th century, the landlord who sues the nuns at an abbey, Seichwald, I think, because they haven't paid their eel rent in 3 years. And it's not a big rent. It's like 50 eels a year, basically. But they haven't paid in 3 years, so he takes them to court and sues them. And that's the first time I'd heard of the rent. Like, I don't have a charter for it. It doesn't show up in other places. So there's a lot of places like that where, like I said, I point to 500,000 or so eels, but I know it's a lot more than that. And those are just the eels being paid in rent. Those are the eels off the top. A lot of times those rents are being paid by fishermen who are paying part of their catch in order, you know, for the right to fish at certain fishing holes, right? So the eel rent numbers, while large, are only sort of pointing us in the direction of the number of eels being eaten and that are sort of being moving through the economy in medieval England. There's just a lot.
I'm a little curious. Is there any information about eel rent in Scotland or Wales?
I think there is for Scotland, although I haven't really looked at it. Wales, not as much. And that has to do with the fact that once you get past the Severn, there aren't that many eels in Wales. And that has to do mostly with the geography. So Wales is a sort of largely mountainous, right? And so the waterways tend to be sort of smaller streams with a steeper slope, essentially. I'm sure there's terminology for that. And
so essentially it's not flat enough for them to migrate there.
They're less conducive as eel habitats, right? They're much harder to migrate up. So eels tend to not bother. So you have many fewer eels in like sort of central Wales than you do in England, right? England is largely flat. Like, I know it has
certainly on the eastern side, yeah.
But like, it's especially like I'm sitting in the middle of the Rocky Mountains in the western US.
I was
like,
just thinking of the Rockies.
It's like England's pretty much flat and cut by so many big rivers, right?
Yes,
like it is. A fantastic eel habitat in a way that Wales just isn't. And there are eels in Scotland, and I believe there are eel rents. It's not a thing I've looked at particularly. Like, it was one of those places where like I had to sort of
limit
the scope of my research, and where part of what I wound up writing about was the way that eels sort of form a particular part of English pre-modern identity. And so that, you know, if I start wrapping Scottish people into that, they're going to be really annoyed at being called English.
I'm sort of curious. I wonder about things like the Forth and the Tay and that kind of thing, as eel habitats. Yeah. But maybe it's too mountainous, even that far south.
So I think there are a number of eels in Scotland. The water's a little colder, which doesn't help, right? So eels are relatively sensitive to water temperature. So when you get...
Okay.
It's not a huge difference. And I mean, they're eels in Scandinavia too, so they're not super bothered by it, but it is a thing. So like, you're probably going to have fewer eels in Scotland than you have in, say, southern England than you have in the Netherlands. I just haven't looked at the history of it particularly. But Wales, I can tell you, like, the geography of Wales is not terribly conducive to eels, and so you don't get a ton of eel rents once you get past, like I said, once you get past kind of the Severn. Now, we've talked about eels some, and we tend to think about eels as being a particularly Finnish kind of thing, not Finland, but like from the Fens. Mm-hmm. And that's true, and it winds up being more true as you get later on. But in early medieval England, there are eel rents all over the country. It's not just in the Fens. They're from, you know, Cornwall all the way up to Northumbria. So they're really widely spread.
Not northern, the general area of Northumbria is where I am currently. I'm currently in Newcastle upon Tyne.
So go out there and get an eel, Lou. What are you waiting for? Go fishing. Come back when you have an eel and not before. All right. Thank you.
Okay, yes.
All right. In the interest of time, we're going to move on to the next. Though I could listen to you talk about this all day.
Yeah, man. I'm sorry. I keep segueing down rabbit holes here and there. And
it's too interesting.
Well, this is basically, okay. It's basically what my dissertation did too, right?
Okay. All right. Next question, which might or might not be related to what you do, but we'll ask anyway. Do you have any thoughts on how eels remain important in the modern day, culturally or economically?
Yeah. So culturally, I don't think they do, which I think is a bit of a problem, at least in sort of what we might think of as Western culture. And that's not entirely true. They do in pockets, right? Like I'll hear from people who grew up fishing for eels from their grandfather's dock in the Fens somewhere. And there's eels are an important part of the culture in like parts of Ireland and sort of the north coast of Spain. And it's like there are pockets, but
we have a Newfoundland actor who, when they first came in, showed us the eel spears they grew up fishing with, because mm-hmm. there's still a decent amount of eel fishing where they are, which was very cool.
So there are these pockets where it's still important, but broadly, it's a thing that we've forgotten about. It's sort of faded into the cultural past in some unfortunate ways that we were talking about earlier. Like that's where I try to like kind of poke people to think about eels, is by reminding them of the sort of the history and the culture we have with the fish. So economically, they're in spite of not being particularly culturally important in the West, they are still sort of economically important. There's the places where, like in the U.S., eel fishing is really important in Maine. Where it's eel is, I think, the second most viable cash crop is the wrong word, but like sort of livestock.
Fishery. Yes, that fishery.
Yeah, most valuable fishery. And not just fishery, but like also like land-based livestock as well, after lobster. So you go lobster and then eel. And, you know, there's an enormous black market for eels. There's a huge economic need for them, or desire is a better word. There's a huge economic desire for them in China and Japan. And, you know, they've sort of overfished most of their own eels. So there's, you know, most of the eels that are caught in Maine are not sold in the U.S., at least not initially. They are caught as elvers and then shipped down to New York, put on a plane and flown to China, where they're grown in tanks and then shipped to Japan and then butchered and then shipped wherever they are going in the world. So like if I go to a Japanese restaurant here and buy unagi, it's quite possible that it came from Maine and had this like ridiculously long trip to get back to me. It's also quite possible that it was illegally caught in Europe, in northern Spain, and smuggled in a suitcase to China and grown that way, right?
We've all seen that news story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, your listeners probably know this, but the eels are like the most illegally trafficked animal on Earth. It's the largest black market for illegally trafficked animals on Earth. It's a $4 to $5 billion a year estimated black market. It's just an enormous, there's a lot of money in it.
I understand there are like there are marks that you can get for like responsibly sourced eels that are better to go for.
There are, and there's some groups in Europe that are trying to really push for that. That's tricky, right? Like because they're a critically endangered animal. That's the other thing I think is really hard to get people's head around. The fact that so every year there are something like a billion eels that come ashore in Europe, right? Like little elvers. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get people's heads around the idea that like an animal that shows up in numbers of a billion is critically endangered, but they are, right? Because they've got this ridiculous life cycle journey.
Their range is massive.
Yeah.
That's what, mm-hmm. a billion across their whole range, which is 9 worldwide. It's not just...
Well, no, that's the European eel. So like that's basically...
only like Sargasso to Europe kind of thing.
Yeah, the Sargasso. So like all pretty much any place in Europe and North Africa that touches on the Mediterranean.
Oh, okay. I follow you.
So that's just the European eel. But they're still critically endangered because like the number, I don't know what the numbers are for the ones that actually get back to the Sargasso. Nobody does, but it's much smaller than that, right? So it's hard to get people's brains around that idea. that an animal that is that numerous is also critically endangered. But, you know, we're talking about the black market. So there's something like an estimated quarter to a third of those eels are caught and smuggled illegally to China.
Quarter of a billion. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, 250, 300 million of them just put in suitcases and off they go. So you asked about sort of the economic impact of it. And I think the economics of it matter because they're part of what's driving the endangeredness of eels, right? There is a lot of pressure to in Europe, they're not supposed to export them at all outside of Europe. So there's a lot of pressure to smuggle them there. In the U.S. and Maine, there are catch limits, but there's a lot of pressure to poach and to exceed your catch limits, and that's not great either. So I think that's where the economics
and there's difficulty too.
Is it better just to not eat them?
This is from a biological standpoint. I don't actually know if anyone's been able to successfully breed eels in captivity, except that it took ages. There's this thing, the eel question of how do eels breed, which was for centuries. So I do not know if this is true. I'm spitballing, but I would imagine the vast majority of not all eels that are on the market are wild caught.
Yeah, no, they are. They have had, you can force them to fertilize, not even to fertilize eggs, but you can sort of take eggs and then fertilize them in captivity. So you can grow eels from eggs in captivity, but they're not particularly viable. Most of them, like they're sort of weirdly deformed and they have not had much success with that yet.
So there isn't currently a farmed eel industry.
Mm-mm. No. Any
so is eel... it better just not to eat eels? Like, you should just avoid it?
I think probably there's a cultural argument for eating eels, which lines up kind of closely with my sort of argument for talking about eel history, which is basically goes that, like, there is an argument for encouraging people to eat eels in at least small numbers because it sort of brings them back into, like, the world people's consciousness, right? Like, where they're thinking about eels and like, oh, I like eels. I like eating eels. They're really tasty. We should save them.
Whatever it takes.
Yes.
The tuna argument.
I think that's a viable, I think that's a reasonable argument to make. I honestly don't know where I fall in it. Like, it makes sense to me, but also it makes sense to me to not eat endangered things. So, but you have to deal with not just like the conservation and the endangeredness of the fish itself, but also like people's reaction to it. So like getting people to think about eels maybe matters in the long term more than letting them eat some eels in the short term. But I'm not sure about that, frankly.
It's a hard question. All right. Oh, we're almost at the end of our questions. We've only been here for an hour. It's just so interesting and we keep asking questions. And bringing you off topic, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I can talk about eels for a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, mood.
All right. Okay. Veering away from eels, but talking a bit more about your current work and research, do you want to talk about maps?
I love maps. yeah. So, like I said earlier, I meant to be a cartographic historian, sort of thinking about the ways that people understand their space around them and reproduce them and make arguments with maps, right? Like, that's one of the things that fascinates me about maps is we tend to read maps as being sort of neutral arbiters of a cartographic or a geographic truth, right? Like, you read a map, like, okay, this is what the world is. But maps are a text. They are a compiled thing that somebody has decided what matters that go on and what doesn't. Maps are always arguments about how we should understand the world around us and what matters and what doesn't. And it's fascinating to me that as we have become more cartographically literate, right, like we all walk around with maps on our phones all the time, like we have lost even more sense of that maps. Like, the more sort of digital and a part of our everyday lives they become, the more we trust them implicitly to be sort of honest brokers of the world around us. And they're not. They are. Every single map you see tells lies about the world. They have to. And some of it is because if you're looking at a map of the world, right, you can't reproduce a globe on a flat space. And so any map has to decide what kind of projection it's going to use to show the world to you. You know, and there's a lot of focus
massively
on...
massively underestimate the global south, don't they? The size of the global south.
Very, very often, right? Like, the Mercator map that we probably all grew up with in school from, like, the 16th century tends to show, right, like, it it places Europe in the center, and the sort of north-south edges of the map are bigger, and so then you get Greenland looking like it's bigger than Africa and things like that. And there has been a pushback against that, and people thinking about, like, well, there's this sort of Gall Peters map projection that shows things that's sort of skinnier and sort of more true to sort of actual geographic size. But
no,
that's
the Dymaxion projection.
but these are all choices that the map maker is making, because okay, so the Mercator map has its problems in terms of how it presents the world, and you can make an argument that it shows you a very like European centric world. But other maps, no other projection sort of shows the world as it is either. They're all making choices about what matters to show you. Like, does it matter that I want you to see Africa as being larger than Greenland? Does it matter that I want, like, what matters to the map maker? So they're all telling you lies, and some of the lies are very benign. They're just like, they're choices. They're choices that the map maker is making about, like, how to make the map legible. So you may have a map, say, that shows a river next to a train track next to a road, right? And just in terms of like their actual like physical proximity to each other, it may be 10 feet between each one, right? And like you're drawing a map of that, and you would separate them out when you're drawing the map so that your reader can read them, right? So they're not just all like one on top of the other. In a way that if you're thinking about them in terms of like actual scale, that's way off. But that's a choice that you as a map maker are making to say, like, okay, like it matters to me that this world is legible and understandable much more than it matters to me that the things are precisely where they're supposed to be, like in terms of like their actual geography. So there's a lot of ways in which maps lie in very benign, helpful ways, but they all tell lies. And that really fascinates me.
Yeah, that's really cool. And maps are what you're working on right now, if I remember correctly.
Yes. So I said earlier, the sort of the world of academia being what it is, I don't have a job as a professor anywhere, which is kind of what I wanted when I went back to school. But so what I've sort of fallen into is drawing maps as a career. So I have a business drawing maps, and most of the maps that I draw are for academic history books. So people who are like, I'm writing a book about X, Y, or Z, and I need a map to show these things that are in the book. That's what I do a lot of. I also do some more artistic kind of maps, but the vast majority that I do are for academic history books. So I've stayed sort of academically adjacent, which is nice. It means one of the fun things about it is that I get to sort of play around in other people's research for a week or two, and then I don't have to write the book at the end of it. I just draw them some maps, and they pay me, and then we're done. But it is not what I intended to do, but it's really interesting, and it's fun kind of work.
Isn't that the way of the world?
Yeah. You just...
I didn't expect to be making eel podcasts as my job when I graduated, but you know, here we are.
Here we are. You know, you go through the doors that are in front of you, and you see where they lead. And that's kind of how life goes, isn't it?
That's true. Mm. All right. Is there anything else we want to cover? Any questions that we have? Lou, you had a lot of questions. You have any questions?
I mean, I was going to start asking questions about the problems with mapping and, you know, when you draw the line down the middle of a country and then the war happens as a result. But I suspect we probably don't have time because it's already 7:30.
We are a little over our time. Okay. Because we could talk about this forever, but then I have to edit all of it. And I'm but one mortal man. All right. If we're going to be wrapping up, is there anything you want to plug? Any businesses that you want to advertise? Perhaps a map-making business?
Right. So I do, in fact, have a map-making business. It's Surprised Eel Mapping. So that's easy to find. And if any of your listeners need a map for a book project or for a gift or wall decoration or gaming, I do maps for all kinds of things. So
we'll put a link in the show.
Map for your D&D game. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've done several for those. Then yeah, they can reach out to me and we can talk and see if I can help them. So
awesome. I'll also definitely link to your website if anyone wants to read more eel stuff and more map stuff, which cool.
The link will be in the show notes.
Links will be in the show notes. If that is all, thank you so much for listening. Thank you, John, for being willing to let us.
Thank you.
You just tell us a bit eels for an hour. Again, we could be here all day. This has been very
no, it's
nice.
It's really,
thank you.
It's really been my pleasure.
Thank you very much. All right. For our listeners, all our normal stuff is in the show notes. You can find our social media, our Ko-fi, our merch store. Everything is as always, in the show notes. With that, I've been Daisy.
I've been Lou.
And John Wyatt.
All right. Thank you very much.